Hey guys, it's Pastor Irwin McManus. I want to thank you for listening to the podcast and joining us from all over the world. With the launch of my new book, The Way of the Warrior, An Ancient Path to Inner Peace, we're going to be launching book clubs across the world. When you choose to host a book club, you get access to exclusive content, to discussion guides for every chapter, to video content for every chapter, and you get to join me on a live stream Q&A where we will be dealing with the material of The Way of the Warrior, An Ancient Path to Inner Peace. So host a book club, go to irwinmcmanus.com/bookclub and sign up right now. So we began just 2 weeks ago a journey through the way of the warrior, an ancient path to inner peace. And I don't know if there's ever been a moment where it's so clear that we desperately need to be in this conversation. While we were in Sydney, just a small jump across a body of water was the city of Christchurch, New Zealand, experiencing one of the most horrific acts of violence that that country has ever known. It's almost unimaginable that one person would choose to become a container of hate and randomly kill 50 people and injure another 50 because they're not the right color, or the right ethnicity, or the right religion, from their perspective. I'm so tired of having to step into these kinds of moments. It's almost as if we're having to have the same conversation over and over and over again. And I wish I could say this will be the last time that we'll have to stand in this kind of experience, but it's not. And even if we have different views of right and wrong and good and evil and what it means to be a human, I think all of us intrinsically know that this is not who we're supposed to be. This is not what being human is supposed to be like. And it is sort of an odd realization that with all the great potential we have as a species, we have equal potential for harm. And isn't it strange that the worst part of our humanity comes to us too naturally? And the best part of us, it seems to come only with a struggle, with a fight. And in fact, if you were honest with yourself and the battle within your own soul, I think you'd know that to be true as well for you. I know it's true for me. When I'm in neutral, I gravitate toward the worst of me. I don't know why that is the way it is. Maybe that's the evidence of our brokenness, of our need for God. But it seems that all the virtues that I aspire to, everything I long to become, that demands of me a struggle and a fight. But when I abdicate this fight, when I just move into a neutral that we would call apathy, I move toward the worst expression of who I am. And I want you to realize that this is a part of why this conversation is so important. This is why this struggle has to emerge and come to the surface. It's why this battle must be taken on by each of us. Because we'll never create a world of peace if we abdicate our responsibility for this fight. And we need to see this moment as a reminder to us that the reason the world is raging with anger and violence and racism and terrorism and war is because there's a war that's raging within us. And we will never know world peace until we know inner peace. And we create all kinds of scenarios and manifestos to justify the darkest part of ourselves. But there is no justification. We all know at the core of our being that this is inhumane. And yet it's in humans. And we have to find our way, not simply through it, but out of it. So today we stand in code 3. The warrior finds honor in service. And we find a strategy given to us by Jesus himself on how to live the life that God created us to live. Because within us, there's always this tension inside of us. This sense that there's something significant inside of us. That there may be even greatness within us. Have you ever had that sense that there's something extraordinary inside of you, but you just couldn't access it? Have you ever been terrified that the greatness inside of you will always remain dormant, or it will always be suppressed by all your fears and all your insecurities and all your weaknesses and all your failures? Have you ever wondered if there's any way to get to the best part of you? And maybe that's a part of why you're here. Maybe it's a part of why you're open or searching for God, hoping maybe God can get out of you what you can't seem to find in you. But I want to be so clear that you are created in the image of God. And that tells me, just as a baseline, that there is greatness in you, because if there's a spark of the divine inside of your soul, it means there's greatness inside of you waiting to come out. But the tension is, how do you actualize your greatness without actually unleashing your arrogance? How do you become great and not lose your humility? Jesus is the greatest man who ever lived. But he did not earn the caption, Jesus the Great. It was someone who lived hundreds of years before Jesus who did. His name was Alexander. In his 20s, he had already lived the kind of life that would give to him for the rest of history the designation Alexander the Great, the son of a king. But his legend was that he was actually the son of Zeus, a son of God before the son of God. Strangely enough, Alexander died at the age of 32 and Jesus died at the age of 33. There are some strange parallels in their life. When Alexander was around the age of Jesus, when Jesus went to the temple to have a conversation with the religious leaders, and they were confounded by his wisdom, at that same age, Alexander was already showing an acute ability to strategize for war, a genius, a thinker, who had an extraordinary level of courage and valor, and seemed almost to have the genetic predisposition to be a warrior king. His father died by the time he was 20, and so he became the ruler of Macedonia and became the ruler of the Macedonian Persian Empire and ushered in an era that affects us to this day. We know it as the Hellenistic era. And you may not even realize it, but your view of reality is shaped by Alexander, maybe even more than by Jesus. I've read that when he was around 26 years old, he was tormented because there wasn't enough of a world to conquer. The student of Aristotle and mentor, he was taught that there might perhaps be other civilizations on other worlds, on other planets. How advanced is that thinking? And he was filled with sorrow, even to weeping, because there were so many worlds yet to be conquered, and he had not even conquered this one. Alexander the Great. Now, ironically, I have a brother, and we grew up in the same grade all of our lives, even though he's about 2 years older than me. And his name is Alexander. And my brother was named after Alexander the Great. And my name is Irwin. Why are you laughing? How strange. I haven't even got to the punchline yet, except I was the punchline. Can you imagine what it's like to grow up from first to 12th grade with a brother whose name is Alexander the Great, and then for your name to be Irwin? And every time you go to school, every time you start a new grade, every time you meet new people, and you have to tell them your names. Alexander and Erwin. And my brother was great. He carried that name so well, and I carried mine all too well. But with Alexander, the dilemma is that he is defined by our definition of greatness as the greatest person who ever lived, the greatest leader who ever lived, the greatest ruler who ever lived. And the Greek Empire becomes the aspiration of all human history after him. But how is it that we would call a man who used power to conquer the world that he knew and call him great rather than the one who came not to conquer the world but to set the world free? So there's a moment in the life of Jesus where this code is unveiled, where we see what Jesus does with his power and how he redefines greatness. Have you ever heard that phrase, absolute power corrupts absolutely? Have you ever said it? Everyone says it as if it's unquestionable. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. But I want you to know it's absolutely wrong. See, absolute power does not corrupt absolutely. Absolute power reveals absolutely. But it doesn't corrupt. And you know how I know? It's because there's only one who has absolute power, and that's God. See, and God who has absolute power is incorruptible. See, Jesus, we find, and we're going to step into this moment, comes to a place where he had absolute power and it did not corrupt him. Not only did it not corrupt absolutely, it did not corrupt in any way whatsoever. See, what happens with power is that it doesn't change you, it reveals you. It doesn't change you, it unchains you. See, sometimes we look so humble, but it's not that we're humble, it's that we're afraid. See, sometimes we respond a certain way when we're powerless, not because it's a reflection of our character, but it's our survival skill kicking in. But the moment you have some power, you begin to change. Have you ever known someone that changed when they got a little power? And they changed even more when they got a little more power, and changed even more when they got more power. Have you ever known someone say, I don't know who you are anymore? It's not that you do not know who they are anymore. It's that it's the first time you actually know who they are. And so I'm going to make a prediction about everyone who's listening to the sound of my voice. You're going to become more powerful in the future than you are right now. Some of you will become incrementally more powerful, and some of you will become exponentially more powerful. Some of you may have, for all reasonable purposes, absolute power in your little world. And if you do not decide who you are now when you feel powerless, that little bit of power will corrupt you absolutely. So here we come to John chapter 13, beginning verse 1. It says, it was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and to go to his Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Now, before we move any further, I want you to realize that what John is doing is he's taking us inside of the soul of Jesus. This is amazing. He's giving us a moment where we can step into the soul of God and see what motivates God. And in this moment, he's saying, I want you to understand that everything that's about to happen is happening because Jesus loved the world, because Jesus loved humanity, because his love was a relentless, everlasting, unending love. You guys may not know Jamar and Kenzie. I mean, they're kind of beautiful. I mean, Kenzie's beautiful, but strangely enough, Jamar is beautiful too. And, right? Come on, let's be honest. And they're engaged. So that crushes a lot of dreams on both sides of the table. And the other day, we were in the back room, and the guy started talking because JBK, as we call him, has a motorcycle, and I just found out he was selling his motorcycle, which I didn't know he had it that long to sell it, but he's going to sell his motorcycle. And the guy's like, why are you selling your motorcycle? He said, well, you know, and he's just trying to like Kim Hop. Well, you know, I'm just really making some changes in my life. And then one of the guys just called him out. You're selling it because Kenzie doesn't want you to have a motorcycle. And he's like, well, you know, she, and he goes, and one of the guys says, no, don't do that. You're establishing a pattern right now. You need to hold your ground. You can't do this. You have to let her know. You could feel it. All the men in that moment were being emasculated because of one man's decision to sell his motorcycle. It was almost like, if you can't do it for yourself, do it for us, bro. Do it for us. Because that story's going to get told by some other girlfriend, fiance, wife. You know what Jamar did for Kenzie? He's like trying to say, no, it's not for her. It's all me. And I felt badly for him in that moment. And so I intervened. And I said, no, guys, you don't understand. Jamar doesn't have to get rid of his motorcycle. But for 35 years, he had everything he wanted except for Kenzie. And now he has what he really wanted, so everything else doesn't matter. It's amazing how love alters your actions. Love alters your priorities. Love alters your view of the world. The things you love when you are not motivated by love reveal who we are. And Jesus, John says, loved his own who were in the world, and he loved them to the end. He loved them through this entire journey he's about to take. Jesus and his followers were at the evening meal. The devil had already persuaded Judas Iscariot to turn against Jesus. Judas was the son of Simon. Jesus knew that the Father had given him power over everything. I don't want to read that too quickly. Jesus knew that the Father had given him power over everything. Now what's happening here is the backdrop. He's telling us, Jesus, everything that's about to happen, you need to understand Jesus was completely motivated by love. And then he tells us, and by the way, Judas, whom Jesus loved, was about to betray Jesus. He had already decided to betray Jesus. And he's going to, in a moment, kiss Jesus, acting as if he loved him and he's going to betray him. And even though Jesus knows this, he's about to do something that's going to change your view of greatness and power. And then he wants us to understand that Jesus was not powerless in the moment. He says, Jesus knew that the Father had given him power over everything. And Jesus had now all power. Now, this may be surprising to you, but before this moment, Jesus did not have all power. In fact, before this moment, Jesus was not operating on half power. Before this moment, Jesus was not operating on quarter power. Jesus was not running on reserve power. In fact, the way Jesus explained it is he said, apart from the Father, I can do nothing. And the way Paul tells us in Philippians is that Jesus actually emptied himself of all the benefits of his divinity. And so in other words, when Jesus was born on this earth, he was fully human and he had relinquished the power of God. Have you ever felt like God has shortchanged you? You ever thought, God, why would you give me this kind of life, this kind of challenge, this kind of trial, this kind of obstacle? God, why would you give me this kind of dream that costs so much without giving me more power? Well, I can tell you this. I don't think you'd want what Jesus had. He had no power. I can do nothing apart from the Father. See, it says he emptied himself. And so when Jesus was born in this world, I mean, think about this. He was born of a virgin as an infant. So when he was born, they had to slap him so he could breathe. They had to close him so he could stay warm and not die from the cold or the heat. They had to feed him so he would not starve to death. They had to pick him up every time he crawled and tried to walk. They had to teach him how to speak. Jesus could not even express his thoughts. All the wisdom of the universe locked inside of an infant who knew nothing and was powerless to do anything. I think sometimes we try to pretend this is not the way God chose to do it. But I want you to realize, before this moment, Jesus was powerless. So, by the way, when Jesus walks on the water, not because he had power. When he spoke to the wind and the waves and they stopped and became still, he was still powerless. When Jesus fed the 5,000, when he fed the 4,000, when Jesus made the blind see and touched lepers and they were clean, and he spoke and the paralyzed walked, and then he called out Lazarus from the dead and he rose back to life. This is all before he had power. This was Jesus without power, just with a relationship to his Father. So now things are going to get more intense, because now he has all power. What's going to happen now? If that was Jesus before the power, and then we even have the hero's journey here. Right after that it says, he also knew, finally, that he had come from God and that he was going back to God. The hero finally understood who he was and where he was going. This is every Marvel story. This is every DC story. This is every hero story. Who am I? Where am I from? What's my destiny? What am I supposed to accomplish with my life? Have you ever noticed that so many stories about heroes, they don't know where they came from? Whether it's amnesia, right? Or abandonment. Whether we can't remember or do not want to. How odd that the hero story is about discovering who they are. And then because they don't know who they are, they don't know where they came from, where they're going, they don't know why they're here on earth, they don't understand their calling, their purpose, and so they are unaware of their full power. Isn't the climactic moment in every great story when the hero finally understands who they are? I remember! And then they harness all their power! And then all the enemies are defeated so easily. Because the only reason they were in the struggle is because they didn't know their power. So Jesus knew that he had all power, that he had come from God, was going back to God. So during the meal, so is a transitional word that says, because Jesus knew he had all power, this is what he decided to do. What would you do if you had all power? What would be your first act if you had unlimited power? Now, I can tell you that if I had unlimited power, I would not create you. I'm just saying that you're kind of more trouble than you're worth. And then there's 7 billion of you. I would go ahead and create me, because I would be all powerful. So why not be a narcissist and a sociopath? I would create minions. None of this free will garbage, because you mess it up every time. I mean, why would God create 7 billion humans that all needed him? Why would God create a humanity that would blame him for everything we do wrong? Why would God create us when he would love us without condition and we wouldn't even love him with conditions? So I'm thinking my first act of power, in fact, some of you, the only reason you're here and not in prison is because you're not all powerful. You know that guy that cut you off on the road? Gone. Right? The girl that's too slow getting you your cappuccino? Gone. That boyfriend? Gone. That other boyfriend? Gone. The other boyfriend? Gone. The other boyfriend? Gone. And finally, one boyfriend looks your way and you're gone. Let's be straight up. Who wouldn't get rid of everyone? I don't even think marriages would last. I know I wouldn't be here. Because we could not be trusted with absolute power. So what does Jesus do with this power? So during the meal, Jesus stood up and took off his outer clothing. I know this is the epic climactic scene. This is when the hero knows their power, knows who they are, knows their identity. So he gets up, he stands up, and he takes off his outer clothing, of course, because underneath that outer layer is an S. No. And then he takes a towel and he wraps it around his waist. And then he pours water into a bowl and begins to wash his followers' feet. And he dried them with the towel that was wrapped around him. No wonder Judas was mad. I think that there are different perspectives on Judas. And one of the ones that really makes sense to me is that Judas was not trying to betray Jesus to result in Jesus' death. And that's why in the end, Judas ended his own life. I think what Judas was trying to do is he was trying to betray Jesus, to put Jesus in a corner so he could finally use his power the way power should be used. I think Judas was trying to press Jesus to a moment of violence where he responded to violence with violence, to rage with rage, to injustice with injustice. I don't think he understood that Jesus was never going to become like him. That he was calling Judas to become like Jesus and calling us each to become like him. And so Jesus ties his towel around his waist and he begins washing his servant's feet. Now, why would that require power? Why would this be the first thing that Jesus does? How is this reflective of God? You see, I think one of the problems with so many of us in our journey toward God, our struggle with God, is that we have a misunderstanding about God. See, I think it's easy to get that God is all-powerful. I mean, after all, if God is God, he created everything, he would be all-powerful. And certainly he would be more powerful than us. So we go, God, I need your power. So we go to God when we feel powerless so that he might share some of his. I get that God is all-knowing. And so I know that I need wisdom from God, so I go to God when I don't know what to do with my life. And you go to God when you're confused, when you're afraid, when you're uncertain, when you're insecure, when you say, God, I need you to tell me what to do. So you go to God because you assume, because he's God, he knows everything. See, those make sense. Even the all-present thing. I get it. Somehow God is everywhere with everyone at all times. I wouldn't even want that power. But God wants that power because God's a God of intimacy and love. But I think what we don't get about God is that Jesus was both fully man and fully God, and yet he relinquished the power of God and he relinquished the wisdom of God. He didn't know everything and he didn't have all power. He had to grow in that. And we go, wait a minute, how can he not have those? Because aren't those the attributes of God? What we can't see about God is that what God is at his core, more than being all-powerful and all-knowing, is that God is a servant. And even that statement seems sacrilegious, doesn't it? Because all of our songs are really about God being a king and God being a conqueror. Our language about God is more reflective of what we want God to be than who God wants us to be. So there are very few songs that actually talk about God as a servant. Because we don't want to be servants. So Jesus ties the towel around his waist and he begins washing his disciples' feet, which is the most humiliating act a person could choose. Jesus was the teacher, the Holy One, the Messiah, the Christ. The disciples should be washing his feet, not the other way around. And after all, once you have all the power you've been waiting for, why don't you just use it You can command someone to wash your feet. If you were Alexander the Great, you would know what to do with power. But you're just Jesus of Nazareth. What a waste of power. And I think this is harder for us. See, I don't think it's difficult to grasp that God is greater than us. But I think it is agonizing to understand that God is more humble than us. Again, why would you create humanity if you were God? I mean, think about this for a minute. We're the neediest species on this planet. We're the only species asking God for help while we don't believe in him. We're the only species who forgets God when we're doing good and remembers God when we're doing bad and then blames God when it gets worse. I mean, why would God bother creating us? And then, okay, let's say maybe he had a slip up, right? I mean, after all, you're busy. You're creating reptiles, right? You're doing the creative platypus thing. I mean, you're thinking, oh, I'm going to do kangaroos. I'm going to try a pouch this time. And you've got things, hummingbirds. Let them figure this one out. And let's do bumblebees so we have an insect version of a hummingbird. And so maybe God just slipped up and created us, because why would God create a species so desperately needy for God and so determined to live without God? I don't even know what it sounds like in the mind of God to have 7 billion people desperately crying out for help and saying, I don't know if you're out there. See, the only way this makes sense is that God understood that to create us out of love would mean that he would have to choose to serve. That because God is humble, because God is a servant, it doesn't bother God at all to wash our feet. See, we don't do that culturally anymore, but in that day and time when a person walked on the dirt and the ground and had their sandals, their feet were filthy, when they entered into a house, it was common practice for a servant to come and wash the feet of those who were more noble than them. And so when Jesus goes to Peter to wash his feet, Peter says, there's no way in the world you're going to wash my feet. And I get that. I understand why Peter was repulsed by this idea, this thought, this possibility that Jesus would wash his feet. And Jesus looks at Peter and says, Peter, if you do not let me wash you, you can have no part with me. What Jesus is saying to him is, I'm the only one who can make you clean. See, Peter, I know this is strange because I'm God, and really, you should be bowing down and worshiping me, but I am the God who kneels down and washes you. And this is going to go counter to everything you've ever learned about gods and about God. But if you don't let me wash you, there's no hope for you to ever be clean. And Peter says, well, then, wash my feet, my hands, my head, everything, because Peter goes to extremes all the time. Just give me a bath, Jesus. Do whatever you got to do. See, and we use antiquated language that doesn't always connect to us, but when we talk about Jesus coming to forgive us of our sin, we don't really know what that means, but I want you to understand what that actually is God telling you, that the only one who can make you clean is the God who is so humble, the God who is a servant, the God who's willing to come down into the mess of your life, into the darkness of your soul, and not to look at you repulsed, but to look at you with love. He's the only one that can make you clean from your guilt and your shame. And he's the only one who cares enough to lower himself to do so. And then he tells his disciples, see, I'm your master and teacher. That's what you call me. And if I've come to serve, he said, you see, the Son of Man did not come to be served. See, I want you to understand, God does not need our service. We need God to serve us. See, God doesn't need your love, but you need his love. And I need his love. See, when Jesus walked this earth, he didn't do that because God needed it. He did it because we needed it. And the reason God created us is because God is a God of love. And the reason he allows us to destroy our own lives is because he knows that love can only exist in the context of freedom. And so we get angry with God. Why doesn't God fix this? Why doesn't God stop acts of violence like in Christchurch? Why doesn't God stop the violence like Las Vegas? Why doesn't God stop the wars in the Middle East and the famine in Africa? Why doesn't God do something about the human dilemma? And what's to me so odd is that any person, any thinking person would understand that if God existed and God was going to stop all of this, the only thing he could do is eliminate us or change us. But because he loves us, even in our darkest moments, even in all of our violence, and even in all of our inhumanity, he does not give up on us. But Jesus' way of peace is not to force peace on us, but to bring peace within us. So what are you doing with your power? And is it an expression of true greatness? See, the warrior finds honor in service. Oh, by the way, it struck me today that after Jesus received all power, he did not perform one more miracle. I'm still trying to work that one through my own system. Why receive all power and then leave the miracles behind? And we would maybe think the highlight miracle of Jesus' life was to call Lazarus out of the dead back to life. But you know what? He saved the best for last. I know some of you thinking, oh yeah, that's right, the resurrection. No, that's a good miracle. But it's at best second. You know what the greatest miracle Jesus performed was? See, you think it's a miracle for God to raise a human back to life from the dead. No, the greatest miracle, the one that not only defies the laws of nature, but the laws of the supernatural, is that Jesus allowed himself to be killed. The God who is life experienced death so that through his sacrifice, we might live. That's the miracle of Jesus' absolute power, that he served us. And this is how greatness is formed. See, the greatness within you will only emerge when you step into the power God has for you. And the power that God wants to pour within you will only be awakened when your life is fueled by love. Because until you have the motivation of God, you cannot be trusted with the power of God. And the thing about greatness, and let's be honest for a minute. Aren't there people we admire and we call great, but they're not that good? In fact, a lot of great people aren't very good people. And we don't want to say that out loud because we don't want to be judgmental, But a lot of times we see people, we admire them, whether it's in the world of sports or in the world of music or in the world of art or film or politics, and we admire their greatness, and then we get a small view, small glimpse of their real life, and we go, oh, they were great, but they were not good. I remember a while back, I think it was a couple years ago, Kim was reading Jobs, the story of Steve Jobs. It's a really thick book. And Kim reads really thick books. And she said, you need to read this book. And I looked at it and I thought, that's way too thick. That's a lot of pages. There's a lot of words on those pages. And I'm good. Are there any pictures? And She goes, you need to read this book. And I said, why? Why do I need to read that book? And then my beautiful, amazing, supportive wife looked at me and said, you need to read this book so that you can know what it's like to be inside of the mind of a genius. Now, I may not be a genius, but I think that was an insult. And I said, how do you know that I don't already know what it's like to be inside of the mind of a genius? And she said, like I said, you need to read this book. I said, so do you want me to become like him? Because without being overly judgmental, it seems to me that a lot of people we call great are either narcissists or high-functioning sociopaths that destroy everything and everyone around them, sacrificing people for the greatness of their ideas. And we still call them great, but we know they're not good. And here's the dilemma as you pursue your greatness. If you pursue greatness to find your identity, you will become the slave to your greatness. And you may become Picasso or Elon Musk. You may become someone that people define as great at some point in your life, but you will be the slave to your greatness. But if you pursue your greatness out of your identity, knowing where you've come from and where you're going, knowing your source of power and your identity, then your greatness will be your servant. And you will live your life knowing that whatever greatness God has placed inside of you was never given to you for you. That your greatness was given to you as a stewardship so that you might serve the world. Jesus took his greatness and all of the power of God and allowed himself to be crucified on a cross, never to be called Jesus the Great, because he did not come to conquer the world. He's just Jesus of Nazareth who came to save the world. And God, who is all-powerful, will never force himself on you. God, who is all-powerful, will never demand you to love him. God, who is all-powerful, will give you your freedom to choose. Your right to know his love or to reject it. Because God is not motivated by his power. God is motivated by his love. So he only uses his power to hear you when you call. When you ask for his freedom, he gives it. When you're tired of drowning in your shame and your guilt, he forgives you freely. When you're done with your past and you want a new future, he brings his power to change the course of your life and your destiny. When you're exhausted from fighting the battle for the war within you by yourself, he comes without reservation to bring peace to you. God will only use his power to set you free, to make you whole, to make you new, to restore your humanity and make us human again. Jesus is waiting to bring the peace that only he can bring. But he'll never force it on you. He'll fight for you and not against you. Would you just bow your heads with me just for a moment and just close your eyes? I just know there's some of you who are in this moment right now and you can barely breathe. Your life is suffocating you. You're just drowning drowning in the choices that you've made in the past, drowning from the momentum and consequences of past decisions, drowning in your loneliness, in your emptiness, drowning in a sense of insignificance, drowning because you're so afraid, afraid of the future, afraid of the unknown, afraid of never being loved, afraid of never having meaning, afraid of never finding your destiny, afraid that this is all there is to life. And I want you to know that Jesus is here right now, and he has given himself as a sacrifice for you. That God has humbled himself and he has made himself a servant, because that's who God is. And he's here to forgive you, to wash your feet, to make you clean, to make you new. But I want to be so clear and upfront. If you choose to follow Jesus, the way of Jesus is to serve. Because if you choose his path, you'll know that the warrior finds honor in service, that Jesus will always fight for humanity by serving the world. And if you're here right now and you want a God like that, if you want Jesus to change your life, if you want to receive what he came to give you through his death and resurrection, if you want to receive the life that only Jesus has, what you have to do right now is give him your life so that there's room for the life that he has for you. So right now, I want to lead you in a simple prayer where you can give your life to Jesus. A simple prayer where you will step from darkness to light, from death to life. Just repeat these words to God right now. Jesus, I give you my life. Right now, wherever you are, just tell him right now. Jesus, I give you my life. It's crazy, but just that one invitation will change your life forever. That one simple invitation is an invitation to ask the God who created the universe to recreate you. Right now, just tell him, Jesus, I give you my life. Jesus, I give you my life. If this is your prayer, I want to pray for you. If this is your prayer, I want you to find the courage and the resolve in this moment to declare it to be so. If you just pray, Jesus, I give you my life, I'm going to ask you right now just to hold your hand up high right now. Just hold it up high. I want to see you, wherever you are. Just hold it up high. Jesus, I give you my life. Anyone else? Jesus, I give you my life. All over the room. Anyone else? Jesus, beautiful, I give you my life. So good. Father, I pray for the women and men who in this moment have crossed that line of faith and have whispered this simple prayer, Jesus, I give you my life. I pray that right now, God, you would just wrap them up in your love and let them know they belong to you, that you will never leave them, you will never abandon them. In the same way that in this moment your love has enveloped them, I pray that they would know that they cannot run so far that they would escape your love, or be so broken that they will not know your love, or go so deep and so dark that your love will not find them. And Jesus, I pray that today would become a defining moment for them, that this day they would begin a life of love, that they would find the power of love to serve a world who desperately needs to know that there is peace waiting for them. I thank you, Jesus, that you guide us on the path. You teach us to find honor and service, that this is where our greatness lies. So we pray in your name, Jesus. Amen.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Mosaic Podcast. I want to encourage you to take the message you've just received, allow it to go deeply into your soul, to allow Jesus to do the deep work that only he can do. And I also want to encourage you to be a part of what we're doing here at Mosaic, to go to the Mosaic app and to become a part of the Mosaic Foundation, to become a regular giver and investor in bringing this message across the world. I want to thank you so much for being here with us. God bless you.